Guys, hello and welcome back. I'm Jojo Fraser. It's time for a Mojo Injection, episode 78. So let's do it. Let's be all in. Push the ego aside, listen with an open mind, stay curious, all these great things. That's how we learn, that's how we grow, that's how we keep changing for the better. And we become the best version of ourselves. And that's what we want to do, right? We don't want to be afraid of growth. You know, the kids got their first report cards of the year. And we were chatting, and I think the seven-year-old was a bit like, there's room for growth. And I think she was a bit freaked out. And I was saying, no, there's room for growth. You know, when you're 90, we are growing all the time. And that is part of our key to a happy, healthy life, is being excited about growth. And that's why I love this space, because we talk about mistakes, we talk about trauma, we talk about lessons and how we move on. And this week, holy sweet moly, I have Natalie Carrez, who is one of the amazing women I helped to coach on the lead up to the TEDx talks. Natalie was all over the press a while back when her partner, which is just insane, stabbed her when she was 8 months pregnant. It was a brutal attack. He didn't just stab her once, it was countless times. And she has put up a fight, an inspirational fight for survival. She's the author of Still Standing. She also does amazing work to raise money for the air ambulance who helped her in the time of horrendous need. Raising awareness about stabbing and knife crime. She's just a force of nature, and she got the first standing ovation of the day. I mean, all the women were incredible, bold and brilliant women. But Natalie's story really is just a miracle. It really is. And we share deeply, and I'm just really honoured to have had time to get to know her and spend time talking about her resilience and her attitude. And it's really lovely if you can tune until the end or watch this, listen to this in set parts as and when you can, which I often do on the run. You know, you've got a great podcast or audiobook, and sometimes it takes a few times to finish, but really hang fire to the end. And it's not easy to listen to in parts, but I think going through a process like grief and trauma and how you can come out the other side is just so powerful. So you're in for a lot of inspiration, and I'm so thankful to Natalie for making the time and for being so supportive. And she's a queen. So I want to do a shout out first to Float Philosophy, who are supporting this episode. They are in the west side of Edinburgh. They're amazing. They're one to watch. I booked my float. I was out there last month. A few of you have been out since. Well, in fact, I don't know how many have been out since, but I know a few of you have. And I've absolutely loved it. It's so good for the mind and the body to just shut all the senses off. And in this experience, what you're actually doing is, it's like you're floating in inner space. You're lying in this little cocoon in the dark, just floating. No music, no lights, no sound, and it's magic. And I'll be going back out soon. It's so good for us to stop, slow down, to speed up. So you can hear more about that and read more at floatphilosophy.com. And I will be getting Nick, the incredible founder, onto this soon to talk more about the research and all of his great things he's up to. But yeah, let's get back to this episode, guys. So Still Standing, you can check out Natalie Carrez. You can get her book, you can find out all about what she's up to as well. But I think we should just have a chat with her now. So let's do it. And just massive congrats again. You should look out for a TEDx talk, which will be going around YouTube shortly, if not already. Mwah. Right, I think we're rolling. Hello.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm good, thank you. I'm good. Just, yeah, getting by. Mum of three and everything else up.
Yeah, it's been amazing getting to hear your story and getting to know about your kind of background and about your like resilience. It's just so inspiring. And the first time you sent me your story, I was just in tears. It was just, wow. I get so blown away by human beings, and it can be so easy to focus on all the negative in the world. But when I hear a story like yours, I'm just like, wow. Like, there's power in humans. We are magical, resilient beings.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, I've been, it's 3.5 years ago since what happened to me happened. And I've spoken about it so many times. And sometimes to the degree that I forget the impact on others who've not heard it. Mm-hmm. And then I get that reminder. But it is that positive story that, as horrific as what happened to me back in that day in March 2016, that there's so much good that came from that day as well, with the people that came to my support, to my aid, and the people since then who've supported me and helped get back to being where I am today.
It's amazing, because when you think back to that time, and you know, people will see the link to your talk, your amazing talk at TEDx, about, you know, having, you know, you get up one morning, you know, you're with your partner who you love, you're pregnant, you're excited about the future, he's showing you affection, you're taking the kids to school, you have no idea what's in front of you.
I know, and I think people find that really hard sometimes to take in or believe, because there was literally no warning, and he's, you know, there'd never been any abuse in our relationship, no emotional abuse, no physical abuse. There had been nothing in his behaviour that day, as you say, quite rightly, we woke up next to each other, I'm 8 months pregnant, you know, and he actually pulled me towards him, cuddled me, twinkled his eye, and was very much like, oh, later we'll have an early night, you know, all of that sort of thing was just, you know, talking about what we were going to do later, what we were going to do that weekend. Even as far as I talked to him as I was shopping in the supermarket that morning, I was off work, and we were talking about what we were going to have for brunch on the Sunday, because it was Mother's Day. So the Sunday after the attack on the Friday was Mothering Sunday. And we were literally talking about, oh, okay, I'll get some smoked salmon in, or we'll have scrambled. You couldn't have got more ordinary. You literally couldn't.
That's just, it's crazy to think. So you're going out and you're going to meet him, and it's all fine. And with the attack, you know, and you'll see in the video, and a lot of people will know the story because it was all over the press. I kind of remember it, I think. But you know what it's like? There's so many tragic stories that you hear, and sadly the world is a crazy place, isn't it?
Yeah.
But when you speak and you talk about walking under this, was it a bridge or a walkway?
Well, I go to this tree lined alley, so I decided to walk into Sutton that afternoon. So my partner has phoned and said about going to a bank appointment with him in the afternoon to sort some money out. And he was running late, so I decided to set off and walk down. He was wanting to pick me up. And as I was walking down and I was on the phone to him, he told me he was stuck in traffic. I got to this place called Trinity Hill. And Trinity Hill is almost like a cut through down to Sutton Town Centre. It's like a big, steep downhill, tree-lined alley that goes into a dead-end road. But I hesitated when I went down there because there's a memorial to a girl who was murdered there 20 years before. Weirdly, that year was actually her 20-year anniversary. And I remember her murder clearly. It was a New Year's Eve and I was back from university. And I hesitated and thought, oh, shall I go that way, even though I could see the town centre directly ahead? Or shall I walk the long way around, which was in front of the church, which Trinity Hill runs behind, this Holy Trinity Church and Trinity Hill behind it? And I just shook off my fears, because I just thought, for God's sake, Nancy, you're being ridiculous. It's a Friday afternoon, it's 3 o'clock, and you know, there's people coming up and down the hill. I'll never forget a woman carrying her shopping bags up the hill, and I have no idea who this woman is, but I remember actually seeing her shopping bag either hand, and I thought, but she's a woman on her own who's just walked up there and clearly has no problem, so why am I making an issue out of it? And so I set off down this very wide tree-covered archway, alleyway, which is when the attacker started to follow me.
That is just, and I guess we all have that feeling of when you're walking and it's a dark night or an area you're uncomfortable with, we'll all have different levels of anxiety. So some people, you know, can go running in the woods. I love trail running, but I never go on my own because of all the movies I've watched and the stuff in the press. But when you hear someone running, some people are just like, oh, it's just someone running. It's fine. You know, let's not let the anxiety get the better of us. And then some people will be like, ah, oh, that person's running for me. But it was like you just had this deep gut feeling that something wasn't right.
Yeah, because I was about halfway down and I could suddenly hear these scuffling footsteps while I was sort of running towards me, someone in trainers, because it's quite the way it's sort of scuffling on the floor. And I remember looking over my shoulder and it was raining, so I had this umbrella up. So I was obviously trying to glance and look under the umbrella at the person. And all I could see was this guy, really scruffily dressed and his head down and his hoodie with the hood right at face almost, sort of pulled right. And as you say, he could easily have just been running to go to the town centre. Mm-hmm. But there's something, and it genuinely was like a sixth sense, just made me think, he's coming for me. He's coming for me. And I quickened my pace because the tree-lined alley comes out into a dead-end road. And I thought, well, I could see that a car's parked and there was a building. There's a Christian Hall thing on the left-hand side. And I thought, if I could get to where that building is, I'll be right by windows, which must have people in there, and there's cars parked up, so there's people around. And so I just sped up, walking as fast as possible, trying, as we all do, you don't want to give that air of fear. So
yeah.
You try to do this whole, I'm walking quickly, but I'm making sure they don't think that I'm running from them, but I am picking my pace up. And obviously, I'm 8 months pregnant. I've got the most ridiculous wedge boots. Typical me. Didn't go into town in my trainers, 8 months pregnant, in the rain, in a pair of wedge heeled boots. I'm trying to go down this steep slope going, oh gosh. And I get to the dead end road and I actually for a second took a bit of a sigh of relief, you know, thinking I've made it. But that's when I could sense him right behind me. You know, it's that invasion of your personal space when you don't need to look, but there's almost like a physical field from someone else that's coming to yours. And I just knew he was right behind me. And I stepped to one side of that whole, please go past. But I think deep down, I knew it was a highly dangerous situation because it was a wide area that we were walking on. He didn't need to be right behind me. And even me stepping aside, it was a futile attempt at hoping beyond hope that he was going to go past. And he didn't, because the next thing I knew, he jumped on me from behind and pulled me into him.
And that, I mean, I guess at that moment, and we know now the attack had been planned, but in your head at that point, you're thinking they just want my money or they just want my purse.
Yeah. There's actually, the first thought I had was I'm being mugged because my handbag was actually on the side that he jumped on. So it's on my right shoulder and he jumped from my right hand side. So his left arm came over me and pulled me towards the left side of his body. So he like almost tucked me under his left arm. And I thought he's going to just pull my handbag off. Mm-hmm. So I was almost struggling to try and get my handbag off my shoulder to get him to let go. Something I'm sharing actually here, which I haven't really shared very often, I think it covered in my book, but the other thing that crossed my mind was that the way his arm came across my shoulder, his hand cupped my right breast. Mm-hmm. And for a split second, I thought, is this a sexual attack? Is this somebody who has a thing for a pregnant woman, you know? And it's the fact that his hand cupped my right breast and it was such a personal place that his hand had ended that I thought, oh, you know, that's different if this is a sexual attack. And clearly now we know the attacker, you know, was my partner. For him, that probably movement in my breast wouldn't have even crossed his mind. But me thinking it was a stranger, you know, that felt a real invasion of my body.
And that must be just so awful. And I'm thinking, because when I see like my husband out and about, I'm thinking of like
his body frame, his shape, you know people, but you've got this big guy hood up. I mean, so did you not see his face? Did he have a, because you can see, like, he didn't put a mask on or anything like that.
No, he got the hood pulled quite far forward. The thing that really threw me was that he had a rucksack on his front. Mm. So he actually had four tops on. Yeah. And under the hooded top that he had on as the last layer, yeah, which was a hoodie top I'd never seen before, he had a rucksack, and in that rucksack was spare clothes and spare shoes. Mm. So it padded him out massively. So all of a sudden he was a slim bloke, but these four tops, yeah, with the rucksack that was underneath the final top made him seem like this really bulky, big fella. So as you say, the senses of feeling a body that you would recognise, mm-hmm, you know, you've got somebody who's multiple, I think it's like a t-shirt, a shirt, a jumper, and then the hoodie, and between the jumper and the hoodie was the rucksack. Oh. So his physical frame, mm-hmm, actually was disguised.
And were you scared to try and look at him in the face, or did you just not, even because of the way he was kind of holding you, you wouldn't?
So glimpse the side profile, and the thing is, just as I suppose was looking at him, or when, because the way he's holding me, he was almost turned slightly away from me, so he got me under his left arm, turned slightly away now, as I know, because he was pulling the knife out of wherever it was that he got it concealed. Mm-hmm. And so by the time he turned back more towards me, and he's just over my right shoulder behind me, all I'm focusing on then is the fact that I can see this big carving knife.
Oh my goodness.
That is, and you're just watching this knife come straight down into my chest, and the disbelief of I'm actually being stabbed. You know, it's, first thought, he's going to hold me up with the knife. You don't need to do that. But no, you're straight in.
So the first blow, you knew in your head, did you just think, this is an attack, he wants to kill me? Or what was going on? Can you remember in your head, were you thinking, this is it, or no, I'm going to fight this, or what goes through your mind?
I was going to fight this, because to be honest, after now thinking, right, okay, this can't be just a mugging, this is somebody who's wanting to hurt me. Mm-hmm. My head was obviously going all over the place thinking, what the heck is happening here? And the biggest question was why? And I was actually, while the attack was going on and the two guys came running to jump in and try and help, they said, as I was, that apparently I was actually screaming that at the attacker, why me? What have I done to you? What have I done to you? Because I was trying to work out. Mm-hmm. I thought it might be, you hear these horrific stories of psychiatric patients who have got out of a unit and for some reason just randomly stabbed somebody. We had it in Birmingham Centre on a bus. A young schoolgirl was stabbed to death by a psychiatric patient. For no reason, she hadn't done anything. So I thought I was the victim of a random attack and it'd be a few blows, but then he would give up and maybe turn the knife on the other people who were on the hill. Mm. But it was soon apparent as they progressed that actually I was his intended target, except I couldn't understand why I was his intended target.
So you had the guys to help you, thank goodness, but mm, there was a point where you were lying and the guys got him away, but then he came back.
Yeah, so two guys came running to my aid, one who'd been walking up the hill towards us. So this poor guy, let's put it in, this guy was walking back from work, headphones in. And he said he glanced up the hill and he saw the attacker jump on me. Mm-hmm. And he thought we were mates messing about at first. He said, but I will never forget your face. He said, the look of pure fear on your face. He said, and I saw the knife. And obviously he then had to make a choice whether he was going to run or come and help. And he came to help. So two guys jumped on him and pulled him down. So first of all, we've now gone smack onto the pavement. I'm 8 weeks pregnant. My bump has gone down, obviously hard and heavy, hitting the pay. The attacker's still holding on to me, still stabbing me, until one of them held his arm back with the knife, which distracted the attacker enough to let go of me. to get his own arm back. So I thought, great, you know, I've got to get away, managed somehow to get to my feet. Mm-hmm. They reckon I'd been stabbed 20 times at this point. So I get up, pure adrenaline, got me to my feet. I'm staggering down the hill looking at my own injuries. I can see the town centre ahead, this horrible, surreal moment, like a horror film where you can see everybody having a normal life ahead of you, like a nightmare.
Mm.
Like, help, I'm in this world here. Can someone come into this world? And I collapsed face down. And as I came round, I couldn't stand again. So I had to drag myself to a pillar to prop myself against. And that's, as you quite rightly say, is when he broke free of the two men that were holding him. And from their reports, they were obviously in fear of their own lives, which is totally understandable. He was wielding a big knife that he was clearly no worries about using. No of him, because he turned the knife towards them as a threatening action. And they said, but he calmly rolled over, stood up, almost brushed himself down, picked up the knife and walked down the hill to where I was. Didn't run. This is the man who's been wrestled by two guys, has stabbed, as we know now, his partner repeatedly.
Mm-hmm.
And he stands up and walks, which is a very cold and calculated. It's not running at me in this het up adrenaline state, walking towards me. And yeah, I just remember opening my eyes and seeing him walk towards me and thinking, oh my God, he's coming back. He's coming back again. It's funny, going back to your point, you asked me about the face. When I saw him stand up at this medley of men, three male bodies, and then he stands up out of the three, I caught a glimpse of his face at that point. And I actually thought, oh, it's Bob. He's come to help me. He's come to save me. I'm excited. I remember that feeling of excitement that Bobby had miraculously got to Sutton, even though I thought he was stuck in traffic, as he told me, and he'd come to save me.
Hmm.
But then when I saw the knife and the fact that obviously he's the same, he's very padded out,
mm-hmm.
I remember thinking, oh, don't be stupid, Nasty. It's an Asian guy who looks like him. It's not him.
Mm-hmm.
And I refused, and I didn't know this until I did my PTSD therapy, so my post-traumatic stress therapy.
Mm-hmm.
I got really angry in that therapy going, but I'm not looking at his face. Even when he walked right in front of me mm-hmm. to stab me again, I couldn't look him in the eye. And my psychologist pointed out, she said, I think it's because your brain had worked it out at this point that it was him.
Wow.
And in order for you to survive, you had to block out that it was him. All I had to do was survive and fight this attacker. If I then tried to take on board that it was Bobby, it would have been so devastating.
Yeah.
I'd have given up my fight. So my fight for survival is very clever what our brains can do.
Wow.
My brain locked off looking at him because my brain knew obviously that I couldn't process that information.
Oh, that's powerful, isn't it?
Yeah.
And how long did it take? So when he came back, and you're probably, are you thinking at this point, where's the ambulance or where's the police? Or
I was just thinking, how is this ever going to stop? I remember thinking, how is this going to stop? Because bear in mind, I've had two guys pull him off me. And I'm thinking, I'm aware I can hear people were now starting to appear.
Mm-hmm.
Again, I'm not looking at anyone else apart from I'm looking at his hand with the knife to see, because I'm trying to obviously shield off wherever he's stabbing me. And it was that case of, you know, my attack lasted 9 minutes from the very start to the point that he was pinned by the police and arrested. It was 9 minutes. And I can categorically say it was the longest 9 minutes in my life. It's a long time anyway, but it was so long. To be honest, it really felt like it was never going to end.
I can only imagine, you know, that it's just... because we spoke about the air ambulance noise, how hard that is still for you to hear, because it's part of that memory, isn't it?
Yeah, because when they're trying to give me first aid, and they first of all told me the ambulance is coming. So I've got police officers who are on the scene, arrested him. They're now pressing on my chest. They're tourniqueting my arm, trying to stem all the bleeding. And they're trying to keep talking nasty, because it's desperate to keep me conscious. And they told me an air ambulance is coming in. I remember thinking, what's that? Because I just wanted to get to hospital as fast as possible. But I will never, ever forget lying in the back of the land ambulance and hearing the chopper coming in and that rotor blade and that sound. And also when they loaded me onto the air ambulance, the sound of it taking off. And I do a lot of charity work raising money for Midlands Air Ambulance still. And I was at an event, gosh, a couple of months ago. And they bought my helicopter in, the exact helicopter that airlifted me. And it came in to land and I just stopped dead. You know, as soon as I heard it coming in, stopped dead. And when it had to go off again to another job, and when it took off, I did stand there literally with tears streaming down my face, and all the staff, bless them, at Midlands Air Ambulance kept going, Natalie, you really say you're okay? I'm like, yeah, no, I'm fine. But it triggers so much that the noise of it literally puts me back into the back of that helicopter at that moment.
It's just, yeah, and it's funny how sounds or music or feelings or smells or images can just stick with us, isn't it?
Yeah, it's almost like having there's certain photo points in time of, I have a very clear photo point, as I sort of say, of the police officer, Cassie, she's processed, she's talking to me, and it was she was talking to me about the attack, and all of a sudden, I clearly remember everything in front of me went sheet white, like literally like looking at a white screen. Mm-hmm. And Cassie was like a black outline. It was literally like somebody drawn on the white screen, this black outline of her. And I remember the absolute fear saying to her, Cassie, I can't see you. And all her features were drawn, her mouth was there, her eyes and her nose. It was literally like somebody drawn a line sketch of her. And I was going, I can't see you, I can't see you, I can't see you. She's going, Natalie, keep talking to me. Mm-hmm. And it was that pure fear, because I think that's one of the points I was very close to not being here. Was people talk about a light or something else, but actually that snapshot stays with me of this sheet, bright white, no detail apart from her being this outline talking to me.
Wow.
Crazy, crazy.
Goodness. So from there, you know, you're taken to hospital and you're unconscious, or are you...
I was actually conscious for a lot of it. So the air ambulance crew came running. They said, it's quite weird, they said they were so convinced that I was going to be in cardiac arrest. They thought my blood pressure was so low, my heart was literally going to stop working. They said that every chance we thought you were going to be either dead or in cardiac arrest, about to die. So they came, literally came running, get into the back of the land ambulance, all ready to perform a cesarean section, which is an incredible thing. They were going to perform a cesarean section. If I was in cardiac arrest, they, in the back of a land ambulance on the road, they would have performed a cesarean section to get the little one out. And they come running in, and I sort of open my eyes and go, and they were like, we're from the air. I was like, yeah, hi. They were like, oh my God, she's talking. She's actually talking. He's like, yep, it takes a lot to stop me talking. But I was so scared of dying that I focused on every little detail. So when I was in the helicopter, I was focusing on a bit of what was outside, focusing on the monitor in front of me, because all the time in my head I was thinking, I can't die, I've got my children, I kept thinking about, I've got two older girls already, and I kept thinking, I can't die, I've got, as I call them in the book, Emily and Isabel, I can't die, and therefore I stayed conscious pretty much for the whole thing. Now, obviously there were moments I must have passed out, and I know there were moments I blacked out, but my fight to stay conscious just stuck there until we landed. I even remember them running, as soon as we landed, they got me across the road from the helipad to the hospital, to the A&E, and they were running down the corridor. It was like one of those films with the lights going over your head really, really quickly. And I always remember the doctor shouting at the top of his voice, going, straight to theatre, straight to theatre. And they recognised I had less than 5 minutes left to live when we landed. So it was a case of running me straight, and they did, they ran me straight to theatre.
And do you know what they did to keep, like, with that crucial 5 minutes? Was it getting blood into you? What was it they had to do?
Yeah, well, they had a line in me, which the paramedics on the land ambulance crew, they battled hard, because obviously when you lose so much blood, the first thing that happens is obviously your veins shut down to your arms and legs. So trying to put this cannula in the whole time, because it was a case of getting fluid into it, get the volume up in my blood. So they're putting this in, and I'm struggling because I remember them kept, I got my eyes half closed, and they're putting it in. They're going, sharp scratch, Natalie. You know how they always say, sharp scratch when you're getting it. And I can't remember how many attempts they had at putting this thing in. And I opened my one eye and I looked at him and went, mate, you don't have to say sharp scratch. I've just been stabbed lots of times.
I was thinking that exact same thing, but I'm like, that it's just amazing that you've kept that spirit and that sense.
And when they said, they looked at me and went, she making a joke. She's supposed to be nearly dead. What is she doing? But what in that time was pumping as much fluids through. On the helicopter, they now carry blood, as a lot of air ambulances now do. Back then, it was still only saline, so salt water. But it was a case of having a volume of something. I always think of myself like a watery squash drink. That must have been what my blood was like, because it was so diluted. And it was a case of just, I had oxygen, obviously, but my whole right lung had collapsed. So that in that time of landing and getting me to theatre, it was literally a case of trying to knock me out as fast as possible. One little funny anecdote, to be fair, and again, I've not shared this in a talk, was they obviously had to call obstetricians, and so we've got gynecologists, they're obstetricians for the fact I'm pregnant and they've got to deliver the baby. They knew they had to deliver her. Nobody thought she was going to be alive, but and they've got midwives and everything else. And I always remember, I'm lying there, I'm pretty much as good as nearly dead. They're just about to knock me out. And this little lady who is the obstetrician suddenly appearing between my legs, essentially, between my knees. And she's there, and I'm obviously on my back, and she's there. And she said, Natalie, I'm going to deliver your baby. You know, as in, we're going to do an emergency section, we're going to deliver the baby. And I just sort of half nodded at her. And she goes, but I need to put this catheter in. And I remember thinking, what, now? And literally, without warning, she went for it and inserted this catheter. No pain relief, nothing. I remember lying there going, just thinking, could she not have just waited? I was going to be unconscious in the next 2 minutes. But it's funny that I got indignant that this woman was putting a catheter in after I've been stabbed 24 times, I've had lines put in me. But
and it's pain. I remember I got one put in with Bonnie, my first child, and I remember it was agony. I don't know what it is. Sore, isn't it?
I didn't care what else I've had done. All of a sudden, I remember thinking, oh my, she's putting it in. I have no idea to this day why she couldn't have waited just the one, literally, but afterwards they got that big, obviously, vat of anaesthetic, as they do, and just knocked me out with the words, Natalie, we're putting you to sleep now and you won't wake up till at least tomorrow. So I was warned that they were going to put me into a coma, and I just nodded. So I remember thinking, just knock me out. I was so desperate to just, I couldn't fight anymore. I'd literally had fought so hard to still be. I remember thinking, just want someone to take over now. I need somebody. The relief of being knocked to sleep was just huge. And I was dead on until the next day in critical care.
How long were you out for then? Do they decide like how long they put you out for, or how does that work?
I think before they knocked me out, they hadn't got a clue how long they were going to do it for. They just knew that they weren't going to bring me out of being put to sleep that day. So on timelines, I think I went into theatre probably about 4:15, something like that, 4:15, 4:20, they knocked me out. Theatre, apparently I came out about 10 o'clock that night out of theatre, sort of 5.5 hours in theatre. They delivered the baby about 5 o'clock, so I'd been in theatre 40 minutes odd before they actually delivered her, because it took that, which goes to show how much work they had to do to even stabilise me enough to remove her. I think they did scans while I was still unconscious, and they just made the decision. It was the following, about mid-late morning, I believe, is when they brought me around. So I was probably only in an inducement after surgery for 13 hours, something like that, 13 hours.
Wow. And did you remember, was that when they told you, you know, she's alive, she's here? Was that pretty much straight away?
It was literally was pretty much the first thing. I remember coming round, the nurse asking me if I knew where I was. That was the first thing. Natalie, do you know where you are? And I nodded and sort of mumbled the QE. Weirdly, the hospital I was airlifted to was a hospital that I worked at for my own. I worked in the pharmaceutical industry, so you know, I recognised the hospital anyway, and I'd remembered landing there. And I said, I'm at the QE, and she went, that's right. And that's first what she said is, Natalie, you've got a daughter, she survived. And I remember just lying, being really happy but really confused, because I knew that I'd been stabbed in the stomach and in the, particularly in the baby bump itself, and therefore none of us thought she was alive. I remember the paramedics, I remember the ambulance crew all asking me, Natalie, can you feel the baby? And she wasn't moving, she literally wasn't moving. So I'd almost blocked it out of my head, thinking she's died and I can't think about that. You know, it's I've got to cut off that. So then they're suddenly telling me she's alive. My head's kind of obviously completely overjoyed, but at the same time thinking, hey, what? she's alive. And it was just this fantastic news. And then they told me how poorly she was. So then it sort of goes from being elated to, oh, actually, it's not guaranteed she's going to survive. You know, so it was, she was still critical. And so, yeah.
Wow. What a crazy mixture of emotions. Did you get to hold her that day?
No, I didn't. I was in critical care at the Queen Elizabeth Hospital in Birmingham. Next to the Queen Elizabeth Hospital is the Birmingham Women's Hospital, but it's a totally separate hospital. The QE hospital where I was has no maternity and has no neonatal care. So Leah was actually in the women's hospital. So she was in neonatal intensive care over there. So we were in completely separate hospitals, completely separate buildings, both in intensive care, both unable to. I had a chest drain coming out of each side. She was in a coma as well. She stayed in a coma a lot longer than I did. The best I saw of her, first time I saw her was Mothering Sunday, which I said was the Sunday of that weekend. So attack Friday, out of coma Saturday. Sunday, the midwives came over with a Mother's Day card from her, you know, which there's all these wonderful charities and organisations that just do incredible things that make such a difference to the person receiving it. So they got this charity who put together this whole pack for mothers of bereaved premature babies who can't see them. And in that was a card from Leah, and there was a photo, and that was the first time I saw her was on Mothering Sunday itself, and it was a photo of her. But I didn't physically see her till the Tuesday night, so it's 5 days really in effect after she was born, 4 or 5 days.
And when did you get to hold her for the first time?
Thursday, so she was almost pretty much a week old before I got to actually hold her, because she was still being ventilated. So
that's tough, you know. It's and when you talk about singing to her, you know, don't worry about a thing. Was that like a mantra for you? You were holding her and singing to her.
Yeah. So that first time Now you'll get me emotional now. Whenever I talk to her again, you'll get me emotional. So the first time I actually saw her, they had to push me in a wheelchair to see, because I couldn't walk and I'd only just had my chest straight out. And I remember she's in a coma and they said to me, you can still talk to her because she can hear you. And even though I didn't sing to her that day, I remember having my hand in the little plastic box and going, sweetie, I don't know, it's mummy, you're going to be safe. Dave's here, everything's going to be all right. And I did say to her, I can't tell you why this has happened to us, because obviously at that point as well, I had no idea what was going on, or so I have no reason why this happened, but everything's going to be all right. And then it just stuck. And when we eventually got put together in the hospital, I had had my phone, which obviously had music on, and I'd had Bob Marley, Three Little Birds, on there. And every day, A, it's a very chilled out song, and B, I played it and I sang that, you know, as you just sang far better than me. I won't do it. And it's to convince her, as well as I think probably as much to convince me. So it's reassuring her everything's going to be all right, even if she couldn't understand what I was saying. It was that soothing, everything's going to be all right, don't worry.
Yeah, horror music. If only Bob knew how that song would impact in your life, and I'm sure many others with their stories, how that would be of comfort for you.
Yeah, so I think I literally, it became almost such a routine thing. And even now, you know, I actually have it on my playlist on my phone. It's just sat next to me now, you know, and I still listen to it now. It can still bring a tear to my eye. Think about, you know, every morning in hospital, I remember it was doing her nappy, playing that, holding her, singing it into her head. When we got home, it was very, very hard coming back to my house because it was the house that I shared with my partner. So all of his clothes were in the wardrobe. The bedroom was pretty much as I'd left it that morning, you know, and how he'd left it. So, you know, all of these things, if you can imagine, you know, like what your husband or partner might leave lying about in the bedroom, all of that was still there. Partly as well because I asked for nobody to move it, because it was, you know, my family obviously offered to clear it away before I came home. Mm-hmm. And I said no, I wanted to do it. It was like a grief. Mm-hmm. I think the closest thing to relate to it is somebody losing a partner and you having to face all their stuff in the wardrobe and face all their bits and pieces, their slippers on the floor, and, you know, their pyjama bottoms under the pillow. But you don't want equally anyone else to touch it. So as painful as it is, part of your healing process is to, when you're ready, box it up yourself, bag it up yourself, yeah, and not have that taken away from you.
It's a bit of a spiritual process, I'm sure.
Yeah. Yeah, it was. And I actually wrote a letter to him when I eventually got his stuff and put it into boxes and suitcases. I wrote a letter. Do you know what? I wish now I'd taken a photo of that letter with my phone, because I can't actually remember what I wrote in it. I just know it. I was very much portraying across to him how utterly devastated I was, and that I couldn't believe that I was sat in our bedroom packing his clothes into a suitcase while he was in prison. And, you know, I was sat here bringing up our daughter completely my own whilst recovering from this attack.
Did you get the letter to him? Was it?
Well, it's gone in his belongings. And this is the thing, he might not see that until he gets released, because it's somewhere in all of his belongings and that were returned to his mother's house. So if they found it, they might have taken it to him, or they might have disposed of it. You don't know, because obviously there's a big thing with the family who didn't approve of me. So whether he'll actually ever read that letter, I don't know. Whether it will be when he's eventually released from prison, I don't know.
When you found out, was it when you came around? Because obviously you find out, you know, your baby's alive, so you're elated, but then you're knocked because you're thinking, well, she'll be okay. When did you find out it was him? Was that after you found out about the...
Yeah, so I think after they'd told me about Leah being alive, I drifted back off to sleep. When I came back round, there's just a really horrible loneliness because none of my family were there. So you can imagine, you've come out of theatre, you've come out of a coma or whatever else, or anybody who's come around for an operation, and you're lying there and nobody's there and you've got no family members. And I've come round twice now, you know, in effect, because I've had the nurse, you know, talk to me when I've come out of the coma, and the doctor be there. I've gone back to sleep and I've woken up again and there's still no one there. And it's that horrible loneliness, and there's just these very official looking people, and this nurse saying to me, Natalie, there are these police officers here and they need to talk to you about the attack. So I hope you don't mind. I know it's the last thing you're going to feel like, but they have to talk to you, because obviously, to be fair on the police, you know, it's a massive criminal investigation. They have to talk to me before anyone else is allowed near me in case it changes anything. And then they came up and asked me what I remembered, and I told them what I remembered. And then they said that the person that they were holding at the police station was Babul Raja, or obviously my Bobby. That and I was just absolutely devastated. I mean, there is a twist, which when I talk on the TEDx, I don't go into because of time allowance and things like that, was that when that policewoman was working on me and pressing on my chest, and I said, and it all went white and I nearly slipped away, it was actually because she said to me, so I was saying, has he gone? Because he was literally arrested next to me. So he's lying face down the pavement next to me. And I can just see his feet in the corner of my eye. And again, my brain obviously trying to protect me, I wouldn't look down at him. I wouldn't look at him. And all I said to the police officer was, have they taken him away yet? And she looked and she goes, they're just taking him now. And she said, Natalie, do you know who that is? And I said, and even though I blocked everything out of my head, I said, I think it could be my partner, but it can't be. And she did actually say, it is. And it was the point that she said it is, was the point that everything went sheet right, because it's almost like my body just suddenly went, what? And then weirdly, I think when I came back round, because then I got really scared I was going to die, and thought, I literally thought, this is it, I am going to die. The fear of that and thinking about my kids brought me back, and then I almost shut it down. I literally would not entertain the fact that it was him. And in the helicopter, I did actually ask the doctor, I knocked him on the leg. I was lying down and I knocked him on the leg and I said, I remember asking him, I said, the police said it was my partner. Did you hear that? Is that right? That he said, and it was because I didn't want to accept. And I was going, did you hear that? Did you hear it was my partner? And he, bless him, being very professional and not wanting to distress me, he just said, I don't know, Nancy, I don't know who it is. They've arrested someone, but I don't know who. So I was still in denial, even at that point, but obviously my head knew. But it was only the only time, and that's why I talk about it in text, the fact that I felt destroyed, was because I've been in denial until literally the police said to me, it is your partner.
And did they work that out quite quickly? Do you think he told them?
He told them what it was at the scene. The reason they worked it out was obviously, I remember them asking me my name and my address, and they asked him obviously the same question.
And he just said
same address. Yeah.
So what's scary is obviously now I've been in a situation whereby someone I love gets really bad mental health and they change and they push me away, but never obviously to this extent. And they were hearing voices like, you're not safe around me, and you know, it was a really tough time. But it was never, you know, what you've been through is like it's a nightmare. It's not just someone pushing you away saying mental health or they're in a really bad state. So it's like, as you said, it felt like a calculated attack. And that's really, really hard for you if you've, you know, you're together for how many years before this happened?
The thing is, I'd known him as an actual couple. It was only a year and a half as a couple, but I'd known him 25 years. So I'd known him since I was a 15-year-old. We hung out all the time. My best friend married his best friend. They used to go on family holidays all together. And all through the years, he was an integral part of this wider group for years and years. And he was always this kind, loving man, almost slightly subservient, you know, like he wanted to please everybody. And only after the attack, I learned that really, in many ways, he was playing us, and he was just creating to be the best person. So if you met me, you'd go, what a lovely, educated, polite man, and so kind, so nice. And everybody had that opinion of him, but he might have told you one thing about a particular situation, he'd tell someone else a slightly different version. Mm-hmm. And he'd always tailor it that whoever he talked to, mm-hmm, that person would have the best opinion of him possible. So even if it was Booth, it was a case of whoever met him, he was the nicest guy. The number of people I've had since the attack say to me, oh, I knew your Bobby, or I met your Bobby once, or my husband played football, because Bob played football with your Bobby. What a lovely guy. Hey, do you know what? I thought that too, because if I thought he was a raging murderer, I probably wouldn't have got pregnant by him. But you
know. it's scary because you've gone through that initial grief of, but it's not just grief, it's like, he's away, but also he's completely betrayed you, and also were you even in a relationship that was real, because it felt real to you, but who was this person?
Yeah, and that's the thing, because I literally looked back right through to knowing him as a teenager and thinking, well, did any of us know the real him? You know, I mean, I've been friends with him over 30 years. You know, they started secondary school together, and they were a very tight group, really tight. And so much so, they've actually visited him in prison, because I don't think they could accept, almost at first, that he'd done it, because it just was so different to the man that they knew. And I looked back at my relationship, and because I found out lots of things afterwards, I'll be honest, I dug every detail I could. So in my recovery, I asked questions. I asked different people different questions. I looked into different things a lot deeper than I'd ever had. And I uncovered a lot of lies that Bob had told me. And the Christmas before the attack, and he told me he had to go to Pakistan as a last minute thing because he has a legal issue over some land he had over there. And he ended up staying out there. And there's this whole elaborate story, including he's apparently got arrested in Pakistan and blah, 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 all of this story. And he ended up not coming home till New Year's Eve. Completely missed Christmas. Completely. It's a big thing for me and my children, Christmas, you know, a huge thing. And he missed the whole thing. And it was only, crikey, it was in the August after the attack was in March, where I eventually found out that all of that was a lie. There's never any court case. He'd never been arrested. He was at a family wedding, basically. He was at a family wedding, which happened. He'd known about for months. He's had the tickets to fly out for ages, although he told me he literally only got the tickets that day that he had to fly. There's so many lies that came out, and exactly what you said, I was so hurt thinking, well, what was real? I remember literally crying, thinking, I can't cope with learning about a lie, because everything seemed to be a lie, and I had trusted him because we 25 years in knowing someone, I trusted him, and it was so, so hard to know that somebody could deceive you to that level.
And you know, I talk a lot about rejection and how we bounce back and we learn from it, but this is more than rejection. This is a brutal attack, and it's kind of thinking, right, you're probably going in your head, what did I do? Why me? As you said, when he was doing it and you didn't even realize it was him, but it was like, I guess in your head, you're just so confused and you're so just overwhelmed, and you're trying to put all the pieces together, and you're trying to raise the kids and look after them, and you're trying to heal. Was there like one piece of advice that stands out for you, or at some kind of comfort that helps you through the kind of process of picking everything up initially?
I think the biggest thing for me was accepting and learning the fact that anybody who goes through trauma, no matter what it is, no matter what level it is, the mind's key reaction to trauma is to inflict guilt. And that all of us will feel guilty. So you might be in a big car accident and you'll start thinking, well, what could I have done differently? Why did I drive that route? Why did I do this? And all of a sudden, you're turning to the mind. That you could have done anything about, but you start to turn it to you. And my psychologist really helping me understand, Natalie, all this loading, this guilt on yourself of going, well, why didn't I see any signs? Why didn't I see it? How could I bring a man like that into the house where my children were? How could I get pregnant by a man like that? And I classed myself as a really good judge of character. How did I let myself get deceived? And then in the end, she was like, you have to stop. Because first of all, nobody saw it. And that's why everyone keeps saying to you, he's a lovely man. And I know it winds you up when people say that. But actually, that is because that's how he portrayed himself to everybody. And actually, you are now doing the classic trauma reaction, which is, I'm going to feel guilt. I'm going to take some guilt for all this pain. Well, I must have done something. And I think that was the best piece of advice, was to say, no, actually, this isn't real guilt. This isn't validated guilt. This is guilt inflicted by the trauma response. And knowing that helped me not beat myself up so much and get trapped. You could easily get trapped in some horrific self-deprecating cycle where you are literally putting yourself in the end down. And while you're trying to recover, you're already down here. Mm-hmm. And instead of building yourself up, if you're then beating yourself up for everything, you're dragging yourself even further and further, further, further down. If you can stop that slide by accepting, no, this isn't real. I am the victim. I have not to blame. I'm the victim. This guilt is not mine. You can start building up.
That's powerful, actually. I would say everyone I've interviewed over the years, I was speaking to someone a couple of weeks ago and it had me in tears because she was talking about when she lost her baby and then had to give birth to her. And the first thing she said when she found out the baby had passed was, I'm so sorry, to her partner. And I said, why did you say that? And she said, because I blame myself. And I'm flooding with tears. She's flooding with tears. And we're going, it's not your fault. But it's so true. It's like this part of our crazy minds that self-sabotage and what did I do? And it's just that there's power in that statement that guilt is a natural reaction, but it's not the right reaction.
And it's understanding that to challenge, when you can accept that and understand it, then whenever you have these thoughts, stopping yourself mentally and thinking, actually, is this a reasonable thing to be thinking? And always is this just my response? And it really is. And inadvertently, you know, things can get said where people don't mean to add to your feelings of guilt, but it can, because you know, a good friend of mine, Madeline Black, who's a lovely Scottish lady too, like yourself, but when you talk, you know, and she talks very much about victim blaming. And unfortunately, we do sometimes, without thinking, do that when we talk to each other. And so I'll ask people who go, did you see any signs? Which is a natural question, were there any signs? I'll say no. But there must have been something. But there must have been, there must have. And like, hang on, and you always feel like going, hang on. One, there wasn't anyway. But two, even if there was, does that make it then partly my fault? Because there had been a sign. And if you're in that natural mindset of having that guilt in you because trauma has produced guilt, like I said about that lady, that horrific experience of losing a baby, it only takes something like that, a question of, you know, well, you know, for somebody like losing a baby, well, did you not feel the baby move? You know, and, I don't, and then it's like, oh, hang on a minute. It could be a really, somebody won't even realise, you know, the impact of that question, but actually as a victim, you are instantly reading any question as, hold on, is that because that's partly my fault?
And that's such a good point, because when you're in that natural but wrong guilt mode, any question is. And that's why this will be really useful advice for people that are trying to help people with trauma, because we say things unconsciously. We're not mindful of our words. We just pick up these patterns that are really dangerous, and we need to challenge that so that people know what to say and what not to say.
Yeah. Oh, I know. I mean, I always fundamentally believe if you're a victim of trauma, whatever the trauma, there seems to almost be this green card to people around you to ask you anything in the world or make comments that ordinarily would be classed as an inappropriate thing to do. But I don't know why there seems to be this thing that it almost like opens these flood doors of people to question or make comment about things, you know, that it's just inappropriate. I put it in my book even about the fact that, I, you know, obviously I lost a lot of weight after the attack, you know, as you would, because of the trauma and stress and everything, you know, so obviously rapidly lost weight after having had the baby. You know, people be like, oh, you are looking thin, you are looking thin. And then when you're managing to eat a little bit more and you might look a little bit healthy, but then people go, oh, it's good to see you put on a bit of weight. Oh, it's good to... I would never go up to you and say, oh, you put on a bit of weight, haven't you? But because she's a victim, it's like there's this green card to suddenly go, bleh. And I don't understand it. And it's what you say, it's people thinking about the impact of their words. I mean, the most insensitive thing, to be honest, I was ever asked, and if this particular this thing, then I'm sorry, but I don't apologise for that. What you asked was insensitive. I've written it in my book, was the fact that my neighbour at the time, who lived next door to Bobby and I, Leah was a couple of months old, I think. I got in her car seat, I was just coming into the house, and she stopped to chat. You know, how are you doing, blah, blah, blah. And I put the car seat down next to me and I'm on my drive talking to her. And she goes, well, so is the baby his? What? Well, you know, people are talking and wondering why he did it. And so just wondering, is the baby his? And you know, you're like, have you just literally asked me that? Are you asking if I'd like to go on Jeremy Kyle, or the former show that was Jeremy Kyle? And I was in such disbelief, and almost a justified thing is, well, you know, people are talking and they're wondering if the baby was actually his, and that's why he did it, because he found out the baby wasn't his.
Oh my goodness. Oh, the things, it's just, we're in a crazy world at times. kindness, think before you speak. And I guess for you, like, were you approached by the publisher to say, do you want to share your story? Because I know as an author myself that sharing and writing a book is it can be an amazing process where you do heal from, like, all the hard things. Whether that's a non-fiction, like our books are non-fiction, or a fiction where you're putting off your stuff but in other characters. But did that help you with the healing process, writing it?
I think, because when I was, the whole part of writing came about was my sister, when I was still in hospital, and I'm all bandaged up, this hand so badly damaged, I'm left-handed, with my left hand all bandaged. And my sister came in with this notebook and she said, I want you to write your feelings down. At which point I nearly told her where she could stick said notebook, because I was just lying in hospital going, well, for a start, man, I can't write because my hand is bandaged and it's my writing hand. And secondly, are you joking? I've got enough on my plate to not write it down. And she laughs these days. She said, "You were so rude about this notebook," because I used all sorts of words like, "I'm doing that." Yet, typical me, I then reflected. And then as the days went by, I obviously taught myself to write with my other hand. And I started to write little bits of feelings down. And then that developed into a diary. And as I started to find out more and more about these lies and this deceit, and therefore there's a much bigger picture here than just my attack, people started going, "You should write this into a book." And so it was about a year after the attack, I started to use the notes that I've been writing every day, and also jotting down all my memories of everything before the attack and right back to when we were kids. And I started to type it up. And I had a computer program and I started typing it. And I'll be honest, at days, I was in tears. As I'm sure you can relate to, I was writing certain sections and I literally could barely see the computer screen because I was crying that much. Mm-hmm. And people would be like, "Should you put yourself through this, Natalie? You're really putting it through?" And at times I questioned whether it was healing me because I felt so awful writing some of it out. But now, or not even now, when I was editing it, which was obviously another year on, mm-hmm. I suddenly look back and it really made me see the journey that I'd come on. Mm-hmm. And that was a big part of healing for me, was to think, "Oh my gosh, I've really come on from this broken shell that I've been writing down in my notes to the person who first started typing it when it was just poor at me and I'm crying on the computer, to now being another year on and thinking, okay." So yeah, it did heal. It did heal and it did help.
Wow. Will you write more books?
I've been asked this a few people, so I need to write, because I write quite conversationally. So anyone who listens to this and then reads the book, they'll probably hear my accent. God, oh, poor people, but you'll hear this broomy accent come through. And it's quite personal and conversational. So I don't know whether I will. It might be that a few years down the line, because there's a whole... The book ends, I faced my attack on my ex-partner. I went to the prison and spent a whole day face-to-face with him. The book ends the day that I see him. So you hear all about what happened and it ends with me walking out of the prison. So that's kind of, so there's a whole, even though there's an epilogue that gives a bit of what happened after that, there's still a whole, there's such a journey that could still be told since then. And an even more powerful sort of message of showing people, and I'm still on that journey, so I can't write yet because I feel I'm still on that.
You're still, I mean, it was 2016, right? So seven, yeah, it's still fresh, and you've learned so much, and it's been amazing to sort of work with you in the lead up to TED and see you just like owning your story and just really with that intention to help people. And I guess there's probably still no answers. You know, you had the full day in there grilling, why? Do you feel there was one thing he said that day that gave you a bit of hope or almost an answer? Or
I think it wasn't so much what he said. It was his demeanor. At the time, it was really hard to accept that I probably still had this hope that, because he said it was a temporary, they call it temporary adjustment disorder, that all the pressure had caused him to temporarily lose his mind, even though it's completely premeditated, planned to have everything. And therefore he acted out of character, as it were. So I thought, well, if I go to the prison, if that's true, then when he's faced with me and with my injuries, and I took photos of my injuries, fall apart, because he's going to be so horrified that he's now facing me, I'm the victim, that he'll see my injuries and he'll fall apart crying and sobbing. And he wasn't. He was very together. He was almost detached. He talked to me almost as if it was someone else. At one point he got irritated because he gave me an answer and then I said, "No, sorry, I don't buy that. You've told somebody lies, just that I don't." And he went, "Oh, well, I almost thought, what's the point of you coming here today? Because I knew you wouldn't believe me." Hang on a minute. Little flash, you're getting annoyed at me. You're getting annoyed. And to that extent, that really helped, because actually I saw this man who was very much in control and all this innocence I lost my mind. I'm the victim of my mental health, that I was out of control. All of a sudden that was taken away at that visit, because I saw this man who was very together with what he'd done. Mm-hmm. And so since then, I've been having learned even more of his lies, that I feel there's probably even more serious psychological issues than what was ever first portrayed. And actually, he's a lot more calculated. And weirdly, I suppose that did help with my healing, because it made me be able to say, Natalie, you've seen for yourself, he isn't the man that you thought he was for 25 years. This is a man who's a colder, harder person than you ever
thought. How long is he away for? How long is he?
I could use that. That's enough. He got 18 years with a minimum term of 12. So he is eligible for parole from 12 years, which is just horrific, I'll be totally honest, because that's what, less than 9 years away. And the protection of my baby, who will only be entering her teens potentially when he's out. I've already got it in place that he's not to come anywhere near her, but the fact is she's a vulnerable teenager with him out, and it is just tick to bear. I wish they'd set it as 18 years fixed, so at least you'd been an adult when he came out. At the end of the day, he's an exceptionally dangerous man. He was very together. I spoke to him on the phone as I went to meet him. He talked to me normally. He was at work that morning. He wasn't showing any signs of agitation, yet he knew what he was going to do. So this is somebody who's been normal. He even bought his lunch half an hour before it. Okay, so this is somebody who's that, I hate to use the word evil, but it is essentially that. Who,
if you're able to eat.
Yeah, to go and buy a meal deal and have it in your car. And although he didn't apparently eat it, but he was all sat in the car, the prawn wrap and the custard tart and a drink of some sorts that he'd bought. But he'd gone and bought, he'd gone around the food hall, Marks and Spencer's food hall, he'd bought it all. And I just think, if you're that controlled, like he was controlled during the attack, you know, walking towards me for the second time, not running, not a man who's lost his mind, possessed. I don't feel the sentence has reflected enough about the psychological state or person that he is, and the danger that he poses. And that's why I'm hoping that he'll be there for the full 18 years. I hope at some point they will look at how dangerous psychologically he is.
I don't think 18 years is very long.
No. It started at 30 years. Started at 30 years because the judge, in his own words, said, you are a very dangerous man. You are a danger to society. So it started at 30. And then, just as I thought, oh, thank God for that, we started at a really good point. They said, but you pleaded guilty. He's like, hang on, he was caught at the scene with the knife by police officers. He didn't have much choice to plead guilty because he was there doing it. So they took a third off. Which is the full tariff for pleading guilty. So it went to 20 years. Oh no, you'll love this, because the best part was he had all these testimonials about what a good bloke he was from lawyers and accountants and doctors that he knew.
Actions speak louder than words.
Yeah, and he'd even written a letter to the judge that got read out saying how he was so sorry about what had happened. And he had a further 2 years taken off, I quote, for good character.
Oh my goodness. Mm-hmm. So obviously, you know, there's going to be thoughts there, but you need to focus on you and, yeah, and moving on. And you said something to me recently about feeling like you had an angel there with you.
Yeah, very and much so.
Tapping into that deeper sense of that. And it was the 20-year anniversary, and you very much felt.
Yeah, and funny, you even said I get goosebumps now talking about, but so there's a girl called Nicola Dixon, and she was, I believe, 17 years of age, and it was a New Year's Eve, very snowy New Year's Eve, And she was murdered on Trinity Hill, exactly the same place where the attacker started following me and where it all happened. And she was in the wrong place at the wrong time. It was a completely random attack. She was raped and then bludgeoned with a rock by the rapist. And he disposed of her body just on the garden next to her at the back of the, I think it was the vicar's garden, because it's a big, obviously, it's, as I say, a big church. Now, it's always felt that Nicola put up a really good fight when she was being attacked, because they found his DNA under her fingernails, and they found scrapes on her legs that looked like she was trying to climb the gate, which went from Trinity Hill to the churchyard. It looks like she tried to climb that to get away from him. Mm-hmm. So I believe that Nicola put up a really, really good fight, but he obviously was a big fella, the guy who they caught in the end who did it. I always feel that day, and it's weird because I'd always had that sensation about Trinity Hill, that I always felt this presence that put me off going down there. Say I hesitated before I went down. But actually, Nicola was looking down that day, and it was almost like she was like, this is not happening again. No way is this happening. And I felt there was an intervention by her spirit or whatever else that caused that. Everything just fell into place for me. The men who came to help me, the young lad who came running and ripped him off me when he was coming at me for the second time, the fact that there were police officers in the town centre on foot patrol who heard it, came running. Everything fell into place. Even the air ambulance have said, the crew on that, and one of them was a military doctor who, you know, seen horrific things, and even he said, Natalie, the angels were on your side that day.
Thanks.
You don't know how you're alive.
I mean, it really is a miracle. It's a miracle that you're both here. And I just think, you know, there is a lot of evil and darkness in the world. So to hear you with that hope and that, because it could go either way, you could be, you know, the victim that could stay with you your life and you say, no, there's no hope. There's nothing good in the world. You know, you could totally have gone the other way.
Yeah, I mean, you literally... There is that tipping point, you know, and I'll put my hands up to the fact that I talk about it in the TEDx, is that there were days I wished that I hadn't survived. There were days that I wished, genuinely wished, oh my gosh, I wish I hadn't fought. Why did I fight to stay alive? Or I wish I could end it all now. There were days that I was petrified because my mum's literally moved in with me and lived with me. And she's amazing. I'm an incredible mum. And I was scared in those first few weeks and months to be left alone in the house, because I had enough drugs in the house with all my pain relief. I had different morphine things for all the different pain. And I had drugs to literally knock myself completely out. And I was scared to be left alone because I thought, I don't know if I trust myself enough to not do it, to not go to the cupboard and just check out. And I went through all of those thoughts, went through all of those feelings, but then I'd look at my kids and I remembered why I was fighting, and the whole point was I was fighting for them. Mm-hmm. And ultimately, nothing else literally mattered. It was all about them, and that's what then gave me my fight about, I'm going to get up, I'm going to do my makeup, I'm going to get dressed, I'm going to look like mum, I'm going to act like mum. Even if I'm hurting and I'm broken, I've got to put this facade on, which is what I did. And you have a choice. You have a choice to sink or swim. So, and you know, it's that whole survive, give in that I talk about, and genuinely giving in was never ever going to be an option.
Love won, because you have unconditional love for your beautiful daughters, and yeah. Love won, you know. Yeah. love always wins. It's the strongest power we have. Yeah. Even when all the darkness can just make it seem too hard,
yeah.
Having that force of love is just power right there, you know, and it gives you hope. And there's so much that happens that we can't understand, but having that faith, you know, and saying, you know, I do believe in angels, I do believe in a greater power, that everything is going to be okay. And I believe that music is a gift, and I believe that that song, which I'll put at the end of this when I'm editing it, you know, everything is going to be all right. You know, there's songs that are important to you. You know, I'm Still Standing and by Elton, and there's songs that are helping get you through and remembering that you are still standing and you stand tall because you're a survivor.
And that's the thing I love about the song, you know, that I'm still standing, and hence why the book ended up being called Still Standing. Had to knock the I'm off so that someone else didn't sue me. But hence why it's called Still Standing and not I'm Still Standing. As my publishers have pointed out tactfully and nicely, you don't want to get sued by Sir Elton John. I was like, no, true. But in I'm Still Standing, you know, it's I'm Still Standing, Better Than I Ever Did, looking like a true survivor, feeling like a little kid. And that summed everything up, you know. I was still standing better than I ever did. I was looking like a survivor, but I genuinely was feeling like a kid because I needed so much help and support. And as an adult, I'd reached out for any help or support. Yet all of a sudden, you know, right from having to have my mum support me and my psychologist support me, I had different friends and also I was allowing these people to support and come into my life, you know, not loads of them, but, you know, select number. So that song for me just embodied exactly everything, and hence why the book got called Still Standing.
It's amazing what you're doing. It really is. And you should be so proud, and your girls will be so proud of you. It's just amazing. And you are going to teach them so much, and they're going to grow up and do amazing things too. So just please keep it up. It's been such an honor to be working with you and watching you get prepared for this. You know, it's amazing. This will go live after it's all happened, and I'll share the video link, but it really is an honor to get.
Oh, no, thank you for all your support, and yeah, just everything, the whole support, the running through, the ideas, the visualization, yeah, just positive power, brilliant.
Well, you're amazing. So thank you for everything you've shared on this podcast, and roll on. You know, the future is yours.
Yeah.
Keep the faith.
Keep the faith. It is keeping the faith, even when it's really tough.
It can be so tough, but you're a superstar, so thank you.
No worries.
What a girl. I just love how she kept a sense of humour. She kept hope, faith, courage. Just an incredible person. Really, really blown away by that discussion. Hope you enjoyed, guys, and could take something from it. And what a song. What a gift. Music is the ultimate gift. Don't worry about a thing, 'cause every little thing is gonna be alright. Why do I keep losing my voice this year? Am I talking too much? About a thing, 'cause every little thing is gonna be alright. Every little thing is gonna be alright. That is a mantra for life, guys. If you're struggling, just keep telling yourself it's gonna be alright. It's gonna be alright. I am worthy of love. I'm worthy of kindness. I'm worthy to be treated well. And when we're not, how can we sort of grow from that? How can we go on and pull on Natalie and do amazing things? She's a motivational speaker. She's, you know, writing. She's doing amazing things. Doing a TEDx. After all of that, she's still standing. It's gonna be alright. Right, it's painful. I'm not gonna sing too much this week. I need to rest my voice. But guys, thank you for being here. Be all in. Wherever you are this week, be there fully. And be kind to yourself. Mwah.